But I'm not impressed by your performance.
Knowledge is knowing that a tomato is a fruit. Wisdom is knowing not to put it in a fruit salad.
We're not here just to take part. We're here to take over.
Hello and welcome to chapter 21 of What's the Story podcast. My name is Danny Murray, or you know, Danjo Murray, seems over there on social media to start now. This podcast is a little bit different, lads. We've embraced technology and we're actually talking to each other by Skype. So we'll do a roll call. Lindsay Danger Doyle, hello.
Hello guys, hey everybody.
And Graham Merrow Merrigan, what's the story?
How are you?
This is great, lads. It's really weird because normally I have you in front of me, but you aren't here today. So I'm literally just staring at a little iPad screen with a little matchstick man.
It's a nice treat not to having to look at your heads.
Jesus. Oh! Jesus. What's your problem, Doyle, huh?
Wait till I'm in my bed.
Merrow, we had to delay this because Merrow was only out of shower and he hadn't got clothes on.
I was all sweaty from your match.
we'll talk a little bit about your match as well, actually, Graham. Ballybrack Bulls versus who are you playing again? I don't even know their names.
Today we're playing Limerick Scorpions. They're the reigning champions and they are the current league leaders at the moment, I think. But I think they're on top. They haven't lost anyway.
Yeah.
They're a good side, like they're really good. They're really well organized, like.
Yeah, they seem to be in the match today, all right. They look pretty useful against you. Like, it didn't go your way anyway.
Yeah, well, it didn't go our way. We lost 70-34. They're a lot taller than us as well. So, I forgot how tall they were. I was going up to shoot.
Yeah, they're a tall team.
Oh, no, there's someone, hands straight in front of me.
Yeah, there was one girl who played for them in particular, a kind of blondie girl who was quite tall. And she was just banging the ball in left, right, and centre, like.
Yeah, she's good. She'd played basketball before anyway, so now she's playing wheelchair basketball. So, she's a good shooter. They're to be fair to them, they're a good team. Like, they're good shooters. They're well organized.
Yeah.
And we gave them a closer match than I actually thought. To be honest, they've played like season pros like Colester last weekend, and they beat Colester, I think 72-18, I think. Jesus. And then so we lost 7-34, so that's positive.
Yeah, and you've had a lot of shots, just a lot of kind of missed baskets, so you were able to get up the court, no problem with them, but it's just a little bit of the... At one stage, I thought the hoop was against you because the ball went in a few times and bounced back out. Like.
Oh yeah, and to be honest, in those times you can't really blame the basket or the hoop when the other team are banging them in.
especially in the first half.
Yeah, no, I was just saying that. Like you said, in the first half, I didn't start the match, so I'm watching it and we're playing brilliant. We're going up real intensely and fast, and then it just wasn't dropping. I was like, would you ever bloody drop?
Yeah.
It was a good match, though, and there was a good crowd as well that turned out up in the San Siro that is St. Lawrence's College.
The San Siro.
It was good fun anyway. Like, that's only the second time I've gone to watch the Bulls play. But, look, I don't know, man. I think he'll get there, you know. There's promising signs. Definitely. There's some good players, like.
Definitely. We're a young team as well, like, you know, so we're making progress every match.
Definitely. Since the last time I seen you, you seem a lot fitter anyway, and you seem to be communicating a lot better as a team.
Definitely a lot fitter, yeah.
I'm not sure about that number six, though.
Me?
Yeah, you.
You know.
He's shy.
Absolute dirty is. I'm getting that. See, we were saying...
He was very aggressive in the end there anyway, wasn't he?
I know, yeah.
I have five fouls, lads. I want to use those five fouls.
You have five fouls? What do you mean by that?
Yeah, you're allowed five fouls.
Oh.
You don't see cats jumping off things because they have nine lives, thinking I have to get rid of these first day.
Ah, no, hang on. Lads, cats, have any of you seen the video of cats being afraid of cucumbers?
No.
It's amazing. When you get them in, it's just YouTube, cats versus cucumbers. Literally, people just leave cucumbers on the ground like behind the cat, and the cat turns around and sees it, and Nickers. It's the funniest thing you'll ever see in your life. But come here, look, we are saying you're doing this over Skype. I'm currently located in the heart of Russia, County Leash, and I'm getting daggers. I'm getting absolute daggers because I went to Merrill's match without cubes. So I'm in the bad books now, Graham.
When I said how come cubes isn't coming, you said she's in Russia. I actually thought she was going back to the motherland and not County Leash.
Yeah, I really need to get a hold of this and kind of, you know, the little slang and lingo that I have, I need to actually cop on, because when I say it to people who aren't aware of it, they take it at face value. Do you know what I mean? So,
no, but you usually say to me County Russia, so I'm like, oh, right. I was thinking, Jesus, Cube's never even said last Saturday or Sunday she was going back to Russia.
Yeah, maybe I should have made that clearer. All right. Speaking of people who are in actual Russia, though, did you see Connacht who are playing rugby in Russia this morning? In a place
I was wondering why that was on so early.
Yeah, I can't pronounce it. I think it's called Krasnahi or Rugurg. But they were playing minus 20 degrees was the temperature on the pitch when they were playing. Baltic.
Jesus.
Baltic, lads.
My God.
So, They had covers on the bench.
Yeah, they'd need to.
It was like they had a load of duvets. And what was that, Danny? And how come the Russian team's there?
It's the European Challenge Cup, so it's kind of the UEFA Cup or the Europa League of rugby.
So Russian teams have been invited into that now, yeah?
Yeah, when they restructured everything with the new EPRC and all that kind of stuff, they restructured everything to try and include sort of third tier teams and second tier teams. And part of that was that a Russian team could qualify, same way German teams can now qualify and all that kind of thing. So it'll no longer just be kind of Ireland, England, Scotland, Wales, France, Italy. It'll now have, you know, other teams involved as well. And in other kind of big rugby news, for the first time ever, there's going to be a professional league in America, the USA. They're getting a pro league as well. So that's only good
for
the development of the game and all that kind of crack. So yeah, lads, I suppose we need to talk about kind of more serious issue. I know we're kind of lighthearted and all that, but the events that took place on Friday the 13th in Paris, I suppose we need to kind of say a few bits about that. Like, I presume, Mero, you would have been watching the match when it all unfolded, would you?
I was watching the Ireland match, yeah. And then I think one of the lads said on Twitter, what the hell's happening in Paris? Something about grenades and shit like that, and I was like, hopefully it's just a rumour or something like that. Then Darren Maloney said it on RTE. He actually said it at half time, like, we're hearing reports of terrorist attack in Paris. So that's when I first heard of it last night. Yeah, I couldn't watch the bloody match anyway with all the fog.
The fog, yeah, it was brutal. But like, I remember there earlier in the day there was a bomb hoax at the German team hotel. So when I first heard it, I thought, the hotel situation there this morning. But then, obviously, kind of, you know, when the phone lights up and you start seeing more and more notifications coming through from kind of more reliable sources, you're going, shit, maybe something is going on. And then, obviously, kind of as the night developed and we all woke up this morning to hear the actual severity of it all, like, it's absolutely crazy, man. Crazy what happened, like.
Yeah. It is, it's mad. Like, I was watching it, and I was watching it on Sky News, and then there was something about Sky News, I can't even pinpoint it, I was saying it today as well, there was something about Sky News that was just annoying me, so I found, Matt Cooper actually tweeted the France 24 English channel, it's on Sky 513, and I just started watching the coverage on that, where it was more detailed and more, I don't know, more kind of accurate, because it was almost like Sky News were just going on rumours, and they were doing the reporting from Twitter and stuff.
Yeah. I find Sky News to be a lazy news broadcaster. They get about 2 or 3 minutes worth of stuff and then just repeat that first 7 straight hours, you know?
Well, that's the thing in 24-hour media now, that, like, in truth, news can only break a certain amount of times and new development can only come in a certain amount of times. So when you see something like that happening, you know, especially in the early stages, you can't have breaking news every 2 minutes, so they do have to regurgitate a lot of what's being said already. And you know, with something as severe and something as crazy as what happened on Friday in Paris, you know, I don't know, I just think that's where sensible media has to kick in, and when you seen kind of, like, I was on Twitter last night, I was following a lot of it on Twitter, and I was following it on other websites and that kind of thing, but when you see what's going on and you hear what's going on, like, rumours don't help. It just spreads the panic. You know what I mean? So having, like, a major news source going on nothing but tweets where they just want to be the fastest one out there, the first one to break it, that's kind of getting dangerous then as well, on top of what is already a dangerous situation, you know?
Yeah.
It's giving these extremist ideas as well, like.
Absolutely. Like, it got to the point where the music theatre that the hostages were in, it got to the point where the police actually had to say, can people please stop tweeting and reporting this? Because as yous are tweeting it, the terrorists have access to it and they know what our next move is going to be. Like, common sense.
I listened to an eyewitness who was actually at the concert, and they just legged it, and they found the door, and they kicked the door down on the rooftop of the actual theatre, the concert theatre, and they just remained on the roof. And then the next door neighbour had a rooftop kind of extension, and the neighbour just, you know, invited them all into the house on the rooftop. So they all went into the next door neighbour's house, turned off all the lights and just waited for calm. But that's just fucking scary shit, like.
It's terrifying. It really is terrifying. Like, when you, to put it into context, it was, you know, and I don't want to make a big deal out of it being just Muslims. It's not Muslims. It's crazy extremist, fundamentalist nutcases.
That happen to be Muslim.
Exactly. The vast majority of Muslims are peace-loving people. Do you know what I mean? They really are, like, and it's not something that I like to see kind of just, you know, racial slurs being thrown out left, right and centre. ISIS have claimed responsibility.
Or blaming the refugees.
Yeah, it's crazy, like. But, I mean, ISIS have taken responsibility for it. And when you kind of look at the areas that were attacked, it was a football match, it was people who are out drinking, socialising, and a rock concert. So, I mean, kind of very much so civil liberties of the Western world, if that makes sense. But if you put that into a context of, you probably had kids at the France-Germany match, it was their first ever time going to see their football heroes playing. At the restaurant and bar, you probably had people on their first ever dates. Could have been somebody's, you know, 21st going out for their birthday. You know, it could have been somebody's first concert at that rock concert. Like, and then all this going on, that must be a horrible thing for those families to experience, like.
No, but it's scary because Islamic State, ISIS, they've been on a week-long campaign. This is like their third or fourth hit in as many countries. They blew up, suicide bomber blew himself up in Beirut, and 48 were killed. Baghdad, 48 civilians were killed. In Baghdad as well, ISIS attacked, and I think 20 or 30 again were killed. So it's a week-long of attacks that have culminated in Paris, and it's just, I don't know where it's going to stop. I was thinking today, you know, as the emotive, people get very emotive on social media, and I see now on Facebook everyone's changing their profile pic to the French flag and stuff like that. And when it's all settled, and when you're all going to think about it, when it's all settled and I'm thinking about it, I'm actually thinking of, like, George W. Bush and Tony Blair, and how are they actually sleeping at night? Because to me, some of their actions have created these terror groups because of the absolute, excuse my language, but the absolute fuck up that they had in Iraq. They've created Islamic State. Islamic State now have outdone the Taliban. The Taliban were there for years, and then, you know the history lesson of the Americans funding the Taliban against the Russians in the 80s and blah, blah, blah. But I've been thinking about Tony Blair and George Bush a lot today, and thinking, like, what must they be going, are they even thinking about, and what are they thinking about?
It's interesting that you make that point, because our guest this week, actually, we haven't actually said, we're 15 minutes in, we haven't mentioned our guest this week was Senator David Norris, and myself and Graham went out to meet him earlier in the week, and we had a chat with him, obviously before all these events had kicked off, and not knowing what the week would have in store, like, what you're saying there kind of echoes the sentiment that he had, in the sense that, you know, the conversation, we'll play the whole interview for you now in a moment, but the conversation kind of led a little bit towards Israel and Palestine and conflict in the Middle East. And while he said he doesn't agree with the conflicts, and he doesn't agree with kind of any sort of attack or any attack on human life and that kind of thing, he did make the point that, you know, the West interfering in process over in the Middle East has caused the reactions that we've seen in the past, and ultimately this reaction too. And, you know, sometimes is it better to leave well enough alone? But, you know, based on what you've seen last night or over in Paris, like, I don't think Anton's going to be left well enough alone at the moment, lads. I think there's going to be some reaction. The French, this attack was designed to bring the people of Paris to its knees, but what it's actually done is it's brought the entire nation of France plus others to their feet. This isn't one that's going to just, they're not going to lie down. This is one that's going to be a retaliation, and I suppose time will tell how big a retaliation, but I don't know. It's you know.
The sad thing about, like, the French president, Hollande, has said there will be retaliation, like, and the sad thing about the retaliation, just more civilians are just going to die.
Well, that's what I was just about to say. This type of stuff scares me, because where does it end? I mean, like, how many people have to die before, say, for example, the French feel like they've had their revenge for what happened today, you know?
Well, it's
a vicious circle. And it's a vicious circle. And
the other side, the other side of it as well being that, you know, ultimately, if, you know, it is boots on the ground, and if it is kind of a proper, like, Hollande used very strong language, you know, he said this is an act of war.
Yeah.
And then he meant, like, they shut down the borders, you know, all this kind of thing. They deployed the army. They're all very, very strong statements, like, and with stuff like that, it's not something that is going to, look, realistically, this is going to impact one generation. War involves young men, and usually speaking, it's older men dictating what happens to those young men as well, like, so, I don't know, like, if I was in the age bracket of 18 to 25 in France right now, when I wasn't already in the military, I'd be maybe looking over my shoulder, you know?
Yeah.
Gonna be a different. It'll be interesting to see how it all plays out. But what are either your opinions on? I'm not trying to be controversial, but just with the way social media reacts to these things, like, in terms of, like I said earlier, the emotive. I know it's instinct and all that, and I'm not I suppose I am a bit, but what, like, you know, it doesn't happen. Say, if something like this happens in the Lebanon. It doesn't happen, like, these civilian attacks, ISIS civilian attacks happen all the time. Yeah.
Well, the fact of the matter is, like, one, the closer it gets to home, the more people start worrying. So, you know, you guys, both of you keep very up to date on world affairs and that type of stuff going on. Personally, I don't, to be honest. I kind of just don't like having that stuff in my life, even having to read up about what's been going on in Paris so we can have this conversation, just upset my whole hippie vibe. But there's people that wouldn't know anything except now they know, say they might have been planning to bring their kid to Disneyland, so they need to consider it, so now they're offended, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, part of the social media thing for me with it all, and I accept what you said there, Graham, that, you know, over 200,000 people have lost their lives in the Syrian conflict, and how many countless thousands have lost their life previous to that in the Middle East through, you know, the war on terror. But, like Lindsay pointed it out there is an element of compassion fatigue. The fact that these people, and I think we talked about this briefly before when we were talking about Syria, when that young boy washed up on a beach in Turkey or Greece or whatever it was.
Yeah.
The whole thing is that because it's a completely alien culture, compassion fatigue kicks in because, you know, it's hard for us, like, let's be honest, none of us have gone on holiday to Syria and we probably never will. None of us have gone on holiday to Iraq or Afghanistan and we probably never will. The simple fact is, though, when it comes to Western culture and when it comes to somewhere like France and Paris, I was in Paris earlier this year. I was in Paris, I was in it the year before as well. So straight away you start to familiarize yourself with these things and you start to put yourself in their position because, you know, how many of us have seen the Eiffel Tower? How many of us have seen Stade de France? How many of us have seen, you know, in movies, the streets of Paris and these kind of things? So you put yourself in that position where when it comes to somebody who, you know, it's a completely different culture, a completely different race, a completely different religion, a completely different society. All these factors, you know, it's literally just, and I mean this in a compassionate way, and it's going to sound dismissive, but it's literally just a corpse on a screen being reported by a news agency for 5 minutes at the bottom of the hour. Whereas this is an attack on what we would deem as the same things we hold dear, you know? So I think
I get your point. I get your point, but I think, and it's very valid. But to me, it's just whether you're going to, there's no terrorist attack bigger than the other. You know what I mean? Regardless of whether you're going to go on holiday to Lebanon or whether you're going to go on holiday to Paris, I think there is equal. They're perpetrated from the same people. It's just unfortunate. Like, you know, it's just sad that I'm trying to word it properly, but it's sad, for example, that the Sydney Opera House has changed its colour to the French flag when innocent people also died in the Lebanon, and innocent people died in Iraq, and innocent people died in Kuwait. Do you get me? I just think that's sad that we value one civilian's life over the other because it's closer to home and it's Western society. Like, Western society, the West has caused this, in my opinion. No, the West has caused.
I know what you're saying.
Do you see my point?
No, I do. I completely see your point, and I get where you're coming from with that. And this would be a perfect time for where I'd normally say, I agree with you to a certain extent, but we're trying to root that one out, aren't we? But the simple fact, though, is that that's how people work. You know what I mean? You're 10 million times more likely to feel bad over something that you can associate with as opposed to something that is completely alien to you. And, you know, an awful lot of people won't know what the background, and I include myself, I know absolutely nothing in truth other than what I see on the news and the occasional bit that I read on, like, Wikipedia. But in truth, I know nothing about the Syrian conflict. I know nothing about the Gaza Strip and Israel and Palestine and the war on terror. I only know what I've seen in an odd documentary or two and all that kind of stuff. But the flip side is, I've been to France a good few times in my life. I've been to Paris twice. I've been all around, you know, I've been to New York. So the September 11th attacks, obviously when I see footage of that, I'm far more emotive than I am when I see a drone strike on a village in downtown Baghdad. All these things play a huge, huge part. And I'm not saying that, you know, one life is worth more than another. But what I'm saying is, when it comes to an emotive response and something like, you know, changing your profile picture on Facebook to include the French tricolour, or when it comes to buildings lighting up around the world to include solidarity for France, but they don't do that with the Palestinian flag, or they don't do that with the Syrian flag. Or the reason for that is, it's an alien concept to the vast majority of people. And while I'm not saying that's right and that's okay, it is, and I can completely understand why. Like, I'll openly admit, I feel much worse for the victims of the people in France than I do those in Syria. And that might make me sound bad, but I'm just, it's an honest response to a horrible, horrible situation. Like,
I think, as well, we don't
respect you with that, but
I agree too, but I don't think that I live the same life as anyone in Syria. However, I feel like I live a very similar life to a lot of people in France. So maybe it's just, it could be me. There's that element of it. That could have been us. That could have been in Dublin. It could have been at a gig in Dublin, you know. But when stuff happens in the middle of the desert in the Middle East, we can't really relate to it.
Yeah.
These things that are happening in the Middle East are happening at weddings. The thing that happened the other day was at a wedding. It's not happening just like someone with a...
But it's just not... It's not on my radar. Like, those two things that you just said, I hadn't even heard about. I didn't realise there was a suicide bomber there the other day or anything. That's...
And that boils down to, again, what we kind of touched on earlier about media will give you what you want to hear, or what they want you to hear. You know what I mean? When you hear a story...
The Western media.
Exactly. How much of it...
The Western media will fill you with propaganda because the West have started this.
Yeah. Like, there's a thing that I was thinking earlier. A lot of people are saying, you know, pray for France, pray for Paris, and, you know, my feelings on the universe and humanity and stuff, but isn't religion the problem? So why would we turn to religion in this situation?
Yeah, I know what you mean. And I'm not a religious person myself. And to be honest with you, I would argue those who carried out these attacks aren't religious either, because I don't care who you are. There isn't any God out there, make believe or otherwise, who would support what has happened over the last 48 hours or 72 hours or however long.
No.
But listen, I think we'll move it along because, you know, it's a really heavy topic. We could spend days and weeks and months talking about it, but, you know, that's not really what we do. We try to keep it light-hearted
My thing is that, like, you know, everyone's doing their own little thing and they're all entitled to it. To me, I can't as much. I'm not saying I can't support. I just can't change something to the French flag or contribute to social media, pay for Paris consciously without thinking about the people in the Middle East as well. I just can't do it.
And that's fair enough. Like, that's, you know, and it's a valid point. But as I said,
I am thinking about them and I do care about them, but I care about the people, the civilians in the Middle East, just as much as I care about the people, there's poor civilians in Paris. Do you know what I mean?
No, and look, and that's fine, and that's a rational approach to it. But as I said, like, and don't get me wrong, I think what happens everywhere else is just as equally horrific and shocking. But as I said, I'm far more inclined to have an emotive response to something that is, you know, a 1 hour flight away and somewhere where I've been several times and a place that I love and I think it's a great city. Like,
yeah, yeah.
But look, everywhere, I suppose. Look, the French hold their three values: liberty, equality, and fraternity. And, you know, it's an attack on those three things for any part of the world. And I think it's one of them things that we haven't heard the end of it. You know, there's people out there who are far more intelligent than us and far more read up on these things than we are. I heard Tom Clonan of the Irish Times speaking about it earlier on. I'd recommend people check out what he's had to say on it. But look, I suppose no matter where people are, Paris, you know, Syria, wherever it is.
Yeah.
To go like Lindsay for a minute, lads, just, you know, hugs, not bombs and shit. Just, you know what I mean? Like, just
Bieber for nothing.
Exactly.
Exactly. No mindless killing, you know. But yeah. Obviously, our thoughts are with anyone that's affected by it in any shape or form.
Don't blow yourself up. Yeah, don't blow yourself up thinking that you're going to get 70 versions. It's not worth it. 70 virgins aren't worth blowing yourself up over me. Or just get on Tinder, get yourself a real girlfriend. That's a sad thing
as well, though, because eyewitness accounts, again, are saying that the lads, though, just one last thing before we go to the interview, eyewitness accounts are also saying that at the concert, people looked and turned to the two guys or the three guys that had the machine guns, and they're saying they'd look at no older than 20.
Yeah, that's...
That's my brother, like.
That's people being brainwashed. That's what it is, you know. They got in at a young age, troubled people who are looking for something in their life, and, you know, somebody is manipulated. I think we should move it along anyway, lads. Yeah, look, just stay safe wherever you are, people, and Godspeed and all that crack.
So this week I was out of touch with the whole world because my iPhone packed in on me. Talking about we're embracing technology today, but I've been cursing technology all week.
So that must have been traumatic for you, Lane, was it?
It was weird. Like, it was bad how it started, because obviously I work for myself, so my phone is my secretary. But I went to bed on Monday night with my phone plugged in charging beside me and set my alarm for 5:30. And then I kind of woke up on Tuesday morning and I was like, I feel like I should be getting up soon. I'll check what time it is. No reaction from my phone. Picked up my watch. It was 7:20, so I had missed my first two clients.
Oh, that's great. That's devastating. That's not like you. That's not like you at all.
That's iPhones for you.
No, well, that's the thing. Like, so it just literally went to sleep overnight and that was it, and I wasn't able to turn it on. But then as it happened, the battery had been getting pretty crap on it, and I was planning on getting a new phone, and one of the lads in work got a new iPhone 6, so he was giving me his iPhone 5, but it turned out that wasn't unblocked, and then so I had 3 days or something for Vodafone to unblock that. So it was nice to have, not have anyone tagging me and stuff every 10 minutes during the day and blah, blah, blah. But then at the same time, I was in work and wondering whether clients were going to show up or not, because they may well have rang to cancel, but they wouldn't have got me, you know?
See, this is where I agree with you to an extent that, I'm after saying it again. I'm going to slap myself in the wrist whenever I say this now, you know what I mean?
Don't be afraid to disagree, Danny.
Or get one of you to rub me nose in it like I'm a dog that's just pissed on the floor, do you know what I mean? But,
I'd love to do that to you if you don't.
But I think I'd last maybe 2 days where I think it'd be nice without a phone, and then I'd be getting do you know, in train spotting where your man's twitching and going mad and hallucinating and all, I'd be looking at it every 2 minutes. And, you know what I mean, I can't go without my phone. It's now part of my body. It's a limb.
Do you know what the most worrying thing for me was? I was finding when I was driving, I was bored, and I was like, you should be driving, you shouldn't be bored. But when I stopped at traffic lights, I had nothing to pick up and entertain me for a couple of minutes. That's ridiculous. Sorry, that's literally what I noticed.
Hang on a second. So when you stopped at traffic lights, you couldn't look at it, and that's what done it for you? Lindsay, you shouldn't have the phone. You shouldn't have the phone in your paw when you're driving at all, you
little
dope.
What I mean. That's what I noticed. That's why I was like, that's a joke. I obviously, at my phone, like, I'm at my phone every time I have to stop at a red light. Because we all know how impatient I am, and I don't factor in the time it takes to stop at red lights. But I have my OCD. And then Spotify, like, I had to listen to the radio a lot while I was driving, and there's so many ads and so much news on the radio, and DJs talk, and I was like, oh, Jesus, I need my Spotify back.
Hashtag first world problems.
This is why I hate the new technology and the new on-demand. You have to be on-demand. Like, I love coming home from work or down the gym with Leon about 6:30, 7 in the evening, and I love putting the phone down and watching the telly and then going back to the phone at about 11 o'clock. Like, I've done that. Maybe the bank holiday, watch loads of films on the Monday, put my phone down at about 1 o'clock, and then go back to my phone till about 8 o'clock. And I had people WhatsApping me, and because I didn't get back to WhatsApp, they text me a message, and it's not even that important.
Yeah.
Do you know?
I got a message. Sure. Why are you sending me on WhatsApp, and why are you sending it on a text? Just in case you'd no signal on WhatsApp.
That's
I'm not sure I'm going to let this fly, Mero, because how often do I have to tell you to put your phone away when you're training? And
Hold on.
Did you text me a couple of weeks ago there and say, where are you, or something like that? And I was like, oh God, why are you in the gym? Did I double book you or something? You were like, no, I just haven't heard from you, or whatever it was.
You're missing my point. My point is that I hate the on-demand service that people think that you are. Like, if you get a text, you have to text back. That was just a joke with you. What I'm saying is that I'm always on my phone. Always on my phone. Yeah. But I could easily just switch off as well.
Come here to me, lads.
And I like just switching off.
Yeah, which is nice. It's nice. Yeah, I like that as well.
Come here, though, lads.
There's nothing worse than when you're out eating with someone or something and they're sitting looking at their phone or, like, it's just that type of stuff drives me nuts, because people are... they're so interested in portraying that they're having an amazing life online. They're actually not enjoying their actual life in the present moment.
But I do be scarlet getting my phone out taking pictures in a restaurant or a pub. It's like, what the fuck? Like,
hang on a second, Graham. Yeah. Hang on. Because you weren't last week, because we were at a wedding last week, and I was Snapchatting that wedding for the world to see, and you were loving life in those Snapchats.
But I wasn't Snapchatting.
No, but that phone was out, and you were all about the attention, loving it you were.
But at a mate's wedding is one thing, but like in the middle of bleeding Mao or Nando's or something, you know.
I love Mao.
If it's fucking four people out at in a pub or in a restaurant, and next minute the phone's out when you're taking a picture of the field, and crazy world we live in.
I like a nice phone or a nice food pic, to be honest. I love a bit of food porn.
Each their own.
But yeah, time. I get it with clients sometimes, and I've had to get a bit more strict with it, where they can I just really dislike that someone can tell if you've read a message, you know, on Facebook or something like that. Because I could get a message at midnight on Saturday night from someone wanting to talk about training, and like, it's great that I'm on their mind or whatever, but I'm like, it's midnight on Saturday night, so one of two things are going on. You're drunk and you're feeling insecure when you're thinking you want to get in shape, and you think by texting me it'll make you feel better, or you're expecting me to get back to you on Saturday night. So, you know, either way, it's not good. So normally I'm just like, just get back to people at like 5:30 on Monday morning, in a kind of a sly way of saying, these are my hours of operation, you know, not midnight Saturday night.
That's good to know. I won't text you anymore on the weekends, Lynn. Thanks for that. Come here to me, Lynn. You didn't go to the wedding last week, but myself and Graham were at a wedding, and it was the crack. I think that's a good way of describing it. Anyway, I to touch back on kind of in the last chapter, we talked a bit about my whole kind of weight loss thing, and part of that was the whole I didn't want Mark Brock to have to, you know, rent a circus tent for a suit for me. So the whole idea was that I would trim down to be able to fit in the suit, which we did, and deadly and all that. But Graham Erigan loves an old crowd surfing moment when there's a good song on.
Oh God.
So I wanted to go crowd surfing, but it wasn't gonna happen. But Mero happily got lifted up. Now, well, actually he demanded he was lifted up, when
did I?
Yeah, when Put Them Under Pressure was being played.
Oh gee, I can't even remember. I wish I could remember. I can't even remember being crowd surfed. This is embarrassing. We change subject.
That's worrying.
Where's Norris's interview?
So yeah, no, just wanted to bring that up and just let the people know that, you know, if you ever see Graham Hedigan out and about and Put Them Under Pressure comes on, fake a back injury, lad.
Lift me up.
Fake a back injury. And I wouldn't mind. It was myself and the groom that were forced into hiking you up.
And who?
Myself and Mark Brock, the groom himself, on his on his wedding day. And there's Meryl.
Yes, and we're not allowed to call Meryl a diva, but at Mark Brock's wedding, he's demanding that Mark Brock picks him up.
Exactly, yeah. So he demanded that Mark Brock get a bit of manual labour in on his wedding day.
I don't remember this, so this didn't.
It did so
I
happen.
I wish I could remember this.
It was a good night, though, wasn't it?
It'd be a bit more of a Put Him Under Pressure Monday night if we beat the Bosnians.
Woo-hoo. What do you reckon? Yeah. One all. We have an away goal. What do you think, really quickly?
Great result. I think we're going to win 3-1.
3-1. All right, fair enough. Right,
lads, can we talk about, I know we've gone a bit fight mad, but the UFC this weekend, Ronda Rousey and Holly Holm weighed in last night and there was a bit of a scuffle.
Yeah, there was. See, we're in a weird position here because we're recording on a Saturday for a fight that'll happen on Saturday night for a podcast that'll go out on a Sunday morning. So
that's why we didn't want to talk about it, Lindsay. Well done.
No, I'm very excited by it.
No, it is. It's going to be a good fight. Realistically, I don't give Holly Holm a chance in hell. I think Ronda's going to destroy her. And hopefully when this podcast goes live and everybody's waking up after watching that fight until 6 o'clock in the morning, they all hear me saying this as a prediction and they know that I was right, like.
That's what I was thinking. We say something and see who's right and who's wrong and then get stick for the next week.
Right, look, we'll go with the three big fights, right? We'll go with Mark Hunt, Bigfoot Silva, Joanna versus Valerie or whatever her name is, and we'll go with Ronda versus Holly Holm. Mero, your three predictions on those?
Hunt, Joanna, and Ronda.
All right, Lynn?
Agreed. But what I will say is I'm really hoping that Holly Holm survives the first round. I don't think it's likely, but from a selfish fan point of view, I'd like to see at least 5 or 6 minutes of it, you know?
All right, okay. I'm going to try on a sidewinder. I think Hunt will win, and I think he'll then retire because, you know, it's more or less a home fight for the guy. I think Joanna's going to get beaten, lads.
What?
Oh, really?
I do, and then I'm going to go Ronda to win then.
What makes you think Joanna will get beaten?
Are you having a flutter?
I haven't decided if I'm going to have a flutter yet. I might go countermove.com and do an L fantasy team there. Like, but
the only chink I can see in Joanna's armour is her shot selection is never really great when she has someone under pressure. So if the other girl can stay put when they're both unloading and get a lucky shot, but I just don't see her not cutting that girl very quick in.
I don't know. You see, my whole thing on it is that the girl she's fighting has always fought at a higher weight class, as far as I know, at least.
And yeah, this is only her second time at 115.
Exactly. And she does have a bit of a size advantage. I don't know. I just think there's something there. I just, you know, like even watching the UFC embedded and all that coming up to it, I just kind of thought this girl with a bit of a swagger about her. So I just think, you know, she might be the one. I don't know if Joanna has the ability to do what Ronda's doing and completely dominate a division, you know. Like the last loss that this Valerie had was Tier 1 Claudia Gadea. It was a close fought split decision that she lost. So I don't know. I think she's got a good ground game. She can grind fights out. She's won by knockouts before.
Dan Joe, she looked worryingly frail at the weigh-in yesterday, and I was watching it with Austin and we were talking what she's done since the weigh-in to stepping into the octagon is now going to be vital. If she had a terrible, terrible cut, which it looked, you seen she didn't even smile when they announced her weight or anything.
You had a bad cut.
The girl that Joanna's fighting,
Valerie Letourneau, or something like that. I can't pronounce her second name.
She looked actually quite stoned, and she had that dead behind the eyes look that people have when they're dehydrated to within an inch of their life. So I hope she got her rehydration and her refeed right so that she has the energy for 5 tough rounds, you know?
Look, yeah, I bow to your superior knowledge and all of that, to be honest, Lane. I'm just, you know, an armchair fan expressed an opinion. But come here to me really quickly before we move on to David Norris, because we're running out of time already, which is crazy. You are heading off next week. I know we'll have another podcast out before, but still, just to touch on it, you got a bit of a boost, I'd say, this week when it was announced that you're going to have a familiar face in your corner for your MMA debut.
Yeah, Ash is coming along with me, which is great. So yeah, heading over to the IMAF, so it's the Amateur European MMA Championships. Really exciting, it's going to be my first MMA fight, and it's a big ask to jump in at the Euros, but sure, I learn best under pressure, so I'm going to enjoy myself regardless. You know, I've just had a little few wobbles the last couple of weeks in that I'd be very experienced in kickboxing and I'd be very confident and I'd know what ready feels like, whereas with MMA it's all very new. I'm not sure what ready feels like, but I know that I'm as fit as I've been, and I'm as strong, and I've some gems from Ash, just some technical stuff, you know. And the last week, because obviously I wouldn't be heavy sparring in case I picked up any injuries, I've been doing a lot of positional stuff with her, so working on how to get out of bad spots, and just tiny little things are sticking in my head, so I'm excited to see what happens.
Brilliant. Well, look, we'll be obviously following it, and it might be on UFC Fight Pass come Saturday, is that right?
It is, yeah. It's going to be on Fight Pass, yeah. Brilliant. But I'm not sure whether they're going to put it on live or they're just going to do the day's events that night, if you know what I mean.
They had it on live and the Worlds were on in July, so...
Yeah.
Well, hopefully, yeah, and we'll be able to keep a closer eye on you then to make sure that you're not doing this podcast any misjustice or anything like that when you're over there. But, yeah. Look, we've got enough faith in you. We reckon you're going to do it, so, you know... Don't let us down.
Don't come home if you didn't do it.
It's bad enough.
Well, listen.
I'm only joking.
I wouldn't be in it if I didn't think I could win it. So why not? It's mine to lose.
It's bad enough that Merrigan lost. We don't need a second loser on this podcast.
Well, I'm not going over it. As The Rock would say, I'm not going to win. I'm going to dominate.
Yes, get in there.
Jesus, lads, these are big words. Imagine I went over and got subbed very early in my first fight. We'd have to edit the whole podcast.
You won't. Linz, I'm going to Paddy Power in the week and I'm putting a bet on you to win first round via toehold.
So we were drilling yesterday in Primal and I got one of the lads in an iron bar and they were all cracking up going, imagine you had a submission victory. How funny would that be?
It would be brilliant.
But like, who knows, if you hit someone enough, they'll fucking give you their back, and who knows, Conor McGregor true. Done it in Cage Warriors a lot enough.
Yeah, somebody might just go, you know, turtle shell mold, curl up, and that'll give you a chance just to sink the hooks in and get their neck and just go right.
Then it'll be literally, you'll hear Owen Roddy go, now Lindsay, put your left hand over here. Now put your right hand there. And I'll be going, okay, coach.
Brilliant. Right, lads, on to our guest this week. He's, It was brilliant. Myself and Miro got to travel out to his house it ended up being in. A man who's been involved in Irish politics for a long, long time, and he's been a public representative since 1987, is when he was first elected to Seanad Éireann. But before that, he was taking the Irish state to court to legalise homosexuality. He was fighting for gay rights, civil rights, human rights, anything and everything that basically made people more equal. This man has had his hand in over the years within Ireland and abroad, or since Europe and the world indeed. So myself and Merrow travelled out to have a chat with Senator David Norris about all these things and more. And Graeme, what did you make of him?
I thought it was a surreal experience to be in the man's house. For him to welcome him into his house was crazy. What you won't hear on the interview, because we didn't record, obviously, but when I got into the house, it was hilarious. Me and Dan just started laughing. He just said to me, what a glorious beard you have. That was the first thing.
That was true.
What about, can we talk about the comedy skit of you getting up the steps to his house? Because that's what I'm devastated to have missed.
I lost a runner and everything. So it's an old Georgian house on Norcray, Georgia Street in Dublin. And, so what the fuck was that?
Sorry.
So there's about, you know, five or six steps leading up to it. So myself and Merrow made the executive decision that, you know, I'll just hoosh Merrow up. There's a bar at the back of Merrow's wheelchair, I'll just drag him up the steps. Like, I'm not experienced in this sport at all. So as I was doing it, I had my foot in completely the wrong position. My foot got kind of stuck under his chair. It dragged me runner off and I didn't have to pull him up in just me sock.
So, and then push himself up with the railings as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, exactly. I had to cling to the railings to haul myself up. And I'll tell you now, if Senator Norris has CCTV outside his gaff, and that's not on YouTube yet, that man is a gent. Do you know what I mean?
Well, he said he's had a bit of a struggle there, did you?
Did he?
He must have been watching somewhere.
To be honest, I was trying to catch my breath. I didn't hear what he was saying at all.
I'd say the security guard was going, "What? Come here and have a look at this. What's going on outside the door?"
I don't think he has any security or anything.
No.
Man lives on his own.
In a big old house. Brilliant, beautiful house. But anyway,
he loved me beard and he loved me teeth.
He did love your teeth and he loved your beard as well. Right, look, come here. We're going to play that interview for you now. And then when we come back, we'll wrap things up. So sit back and enjoy. This is Senator David Norris. All right, so myself and Graham have made the long journey, took us a little bit longer than we would have liked, out to North Great Georgia Street to meet its most famous resident, a man who's given an entire life to human rights campaigns, civil rights campaigns, and politics. Senator David Norris, firstly, thanks, man, for bringing us into your beautiful home.
Well, thank you for coming. It's very good indeed to see you. We've already had quite a laugh.
Yeah, we have indeed, yeah. Very, very warm reception, but even just looking around the house, it's spectacular. Like.
Yes, well, you've only seen a bit of it. The rooms with the best plasterwork are upstairs. But when I bought this, it was in multiple occupancy. There were a lot of young Trinity students, doctors, and so on. And then in this room, there was a family living in this one room. And they had a bathroom down at the end of the passage. But they were extremely nice people, and they'd lived here all their lives as a mother, father, and daughter. And we became friends, and I became almost part of their family. So it was absolutely lovely. At Christmas, I was always put up a tree. I'd always had two trees, one for myself upstairs and one for all of us in the hall. And I'd put it up, and I'd be decorating and so on. And they always seemed to know, and just when I finished decorating, the door would open and they'd say, "Would you like to come in for a glass of whiskey by the fire?" It was really lovely, part of Christmas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we're coming into that time of year again, actually. So
we are indeed. Yeah.
Lovely time of year.
Yeah.
So obviously, you were telling Graham as well, this entire street, North Great Georgia Street, at one time or another was almost derelict.
It was Well, I moved into it about nearly 40 years ago. And the lower end of the street had started to unravel. There was a car park on the left-hand side, this side of the street going up, where they demolished the houses. And on the other side, there were two houses demolished and another four that were in very bad condition. They had single mothers who had now become middle-aged, who had been put in there by the Legion of Mary. But they hadn't done any repairs on the houses, and they were in an unspeakable condition. Then next to that, there was a semi-derelict house with the roof half off it, and I was looking out of my drawing room window at it. And I couldn't bear that, so I decided to start the James Joyce Cultural Centre, which is now over there. And we eventually got it out of the corporation. And we raised several million pounds over the years, and we completely restored the plasterwork. The whole thing is completely architecturally restored. We have some of the furniture of a flat in Paris where Joyce wrote part of Finnegan's Wake. We were bought there, so it's there. We have some manuscripts, some postcards. We have exhibitions, we have reading groups, and it's really terrific because there's the interest both in the architecture of the house and the plasterwork and also its connection with Joyce, which is very slight. It's just in 1904, the tenant of the back room on the ground floor was a Professor Dennis J. McGinney, who was a dancing master. And he appears several times in Ulysses, floating in and out of the pages, very eccentrically dressed and mincing along as a dancing master. So that's the connection.
And you're obviously doing a huge James Joyce fan. You're famous for being a big advocate of Bloomsday and that kind of thing. And
I got involved in Joyce when, like Georgian architecture, wasn't at all popular 40, 50 years ago. And Joyce was an absolute anathema. He was a bad Catholic, he was a renegade Irishman. He ran away, he didn't get married to his wife for 40 years and all this kind of stuff. He was a stink in the nostrils of art, really. And I like to think that I helped to rehabilitate him. And for example, for the first time in 1982, for the centenary, I got a couple of government ministers on board and they published a stamp in his memory, an awful stamp, by the way, but because they did a Brancusi drawing, and it's kind of a line drawing, and you know the stamp actually was a white stamp with this black line drawing. It looked absolutely empty until you looked at it closely. It looked just like a piece of white paper, but it did help to rehabilitate Joyce. And I never studied Joyce in college, so he was my discovery. I've been interested in him since I was about 9. And
since 9?
Yes.
How did you come across him at 9?
Well,
years of age?
I had a very glamorous uncle who travelled abroad a great deal, but he never severed his connections with Ireland, and he always kept a little travelling library with him. And he had a correspondence, for example, with Brendan Behan. And he was interested in Joyce, and when I was 9, I stole 2 of his cigars and a copy of Joyce. It was Dubliners. And I read it, and it struck me this fellow Joyce hadn't a clue how to tell a story, because they kind of wandered around and never got anywhere. They never arrived. There was none of this kind of bang, smack in the face, end of story. You know, like Guy de Maupassant, a diamond necklace is borrowed and lost, and then the people ruin themselves replacing it. And at the end, it turns out, oh, but that necklace, it was only paste. Bang, smack in the face, end of story. The first story in Dubliners ends with the querulous voice of an old woman saying, "So Denikars, when they seen that, they realised something had gone wrong with them. Dot, dot, dot. There isn't even a bloody full stop. It just evaporates off the page. So where are you? Where are you left? What are you left with?" So Joyce had a very modern way of telling a story. You got the elements, you got the clues of it, but you had to put them together and work it out yourself. What had gone wrong with Father Flynn? And you have to use the evidence of the story. It's wonderful.
I did try read Ulysses when I was like 16, 17.
Yeah.
It just got so, there were so many words that I just,
yes.
I didn't know whether it was coming or going.
Well, it starts off reasonably easily and then gets more difficult all the way through.
What does that say about me?
But you started at the wrong end. You should have started with the biography by Richard Ellman, which is such a compelling, fascinating human story. And he binds into that an analysis of Joyce's writing so that it becomes much plainer. And then you could have started with Dubliners, which are short stories that reflect the Dublin of his period, or A Portrait of the Artist, which anybody who's been to an Irish school can appreciate and understand. So I think you started in the middle. Or at the end, yes. Well, there is Finnegan's Wake, which is even more difficult. But I discovered quite early on that the clue to Joyce is not to just leave the words on the page and read them silently, but to listen to them, to listen to the sound. And the example I always give is one of the most complicated episodes is the third episode, Proteus, which deals with change and mutability and all these kind of abstract theological, theosophical, philosophical concepts and so on. And Joyce is full of all kinds of arcane references to philosophy and stuff. But right, Joyce has his young artist, Stephen Hero, pondering on the problem of the artist, how to fix forever a moment through art in a life that is always full of change and chaos and so on and so forth. And he's walking along Sandeman Strand into eternity. And as he walks, he's writing with a stump of pencil and a scrap of paper. And Joyce has given him all kinds of intellectual weapons, but these are his two physical weapons, not metaphysical, but physical weapons, a stump of pencil and a scrap of paper. And as he walks, he's writing, and then suddenly there comes in this odd thing, HSSERSSEIOOOS. What is it? Is it a misprint? It's actually the moment when the miracle takes place, because Stephen is capturing in the letters of the alphabet the sound of a wave as it crashes on the shore. Listen, a four-worded wave speech. And when you hear it, of course it's a wave, but most people don't have the courage or the imagination to jump in and try to see what it might sound like. You know? And all this is a 100-letter thunder word at the beginning of Finnegan's Wake, you know, and I counted off all the syllables, scanned them, and then started to say them, and I learnt it off, you know. The fall. And of course, it's a peal of thunder when you hear it. But most people don't bother with 100 letters, 2.5 lines, you know, of one word.
Yeah.
You know, they give up.
It's fascinating that, like, because I'll be honest, I've never attempted to read Joyce. Probably much to my own detriment, I guess. What do you say?
Well, life is short. Perhaps you've read other things like Lolita.
But the passion that you speak about for Joyce, do you share that passion amongst other things as well, or would Joyce be something?
Oh yes, like, no. I get these kind of obsessions. I mean, for example, although I was classically trained in music, I have a real love of early jazz because I grew up in Ballsbridge, and one of my neighbours, his father was educated in England, and in 1919, the original Dixieland jazz band sailed across the Atlantic and came to London. And they were the resident band of the Hammersmith Palais de Dance. And we had old records of Mr. Morn's, and we listened to them. They were absolutely wonderful. I mean, 5-part improvised counterpoint. Unbelievable. Like Bach, the trumpet, the cornet, trombone, clarinet, piano and drums. Absolutely wonderful. And they wrote and recorded the first jazz music ever recorded. They were the first people to use the word jazz. They've been quite discriminated against because they were white, because overcompensating for the racism, anybody who was white in early jazz was kind of discounted completely. But they wrote and recorded a lot of the great standards like Sensation Rag, Tiger Rag, Blue and the Blues, Clarinet Marmalade. These were all recorded in New York in 1917, 1918. And before that, there was one record that was never published, and I have even got a copy of that. It was recorded in the Columbia Broadcasting People, a studio in New York, in 1916. And I have a re-recording of it. It's at the Darktown Strutters Ball on one side and Indiana on the other.
Brilliant. So jazz, and you say you're classically trained as well.
Yes, I learned the piano with a wonderful woman called Lily Huben in the Reed Piano Forte School in Harcourt Street. And Miss Reed was like something out of St. Trinian's, all kind of furs and rugs and wraps and earrings and hair piled up and all this kind of stuff. She was wonderful. But Lily was terrific. She'd been Alfred Cortot's, who was the great pianist of the 1920s. She was his demonstration pupil in the conservatoire in Paris in the 1920s. Mm. So she knew all the intellectual life of Paris at that period. And so she was absolutely fascinating, wonderful woman. And I really loved and still love Frédéric Chopin. I think Chopin is the greatest composer for the piano.
And Chopsticks, that was Chopin.
No, he wrote the Raindrop Prelude, the Revolutionary Study, all these sort of things. Yeah. Yes, the Revolutionary Polonaise.
And we've seen a piano inside as we walked in. Do you still play from time to time?
Well, very occasionally. And I have another piano upstairs, a grand piano upstairs, which was an 1839 Broadwood. So Chopin died in 1849. So if, like Liszt, he had come to Ireland, he could have played that piano. So that's a rather interesting thought. Of course, he didn't come to Ireland.
Yeah.
Just going back further, David, you were kind of brought up in Ballsbridge. Your ancestral home is County Leash.
Yes.
You were actually born in the Congo.
I was, absolutely. We came back when I was 6 months old, so I have no memories of it at all. But my cousins from Leash turned up at the boat to see with their eyes out on stalks. This was towards the end of the war, and everything was rather grey, and they were thrilled at the idea of a little black cousin, and they've never forgiven me for the disappointment.
So
I was putty coloured just like themselves and the two of you.
Yeah. Although you like to think you have a bit of a tan going on.
Sometimes
you have not. You're a white-skinned broth of an Irish boy.
How was it that your father was working in Congo?
My father was English, and he came over here. He was very heavily decorated in the First World War in the Navy. And then he lost his money in the crash. And he came over here. His sister had married an Irishman who had property in Ireland and in England, a Mr. Montgomery Martin. She married him. And my uncle came over for a tennis party in 1930. And my mother was from Leash, and she was also at the tennis party. And he swept her off her feet and carted her off from the bogs of Leash straight to Central Africa, stopping only at 8 o'clock in the morning to get married in St. Anne's Church in Dawson Street.
Oh my God.
Yeah, where so other fine, yeah. members of the family had been married, including Bram Stoker, who was a cousin of my great-grandfather's, wrote Dracula. Yeah. They were a medical family.
So you can trace your family that far back as well? Like,
yes. Yeah. On my mother's side, I can trace it back to the crack of doom, if you believe all this rubbish.
Nice way of putting it, that, yeah. actually. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, everybody has the same number, in my opinion, of paupers, prostitutes and princesses and pawnbrokers. But some people just haven't got the way of finding them, you know. But sometimes if you're lucky, you have a little string and you can give it a pull and you can trace it all the way through. And when they had Dracula as Book of the City some couple of years ago, various Stokers, including Bram's grandsons and so on, came here. They had a big festival and academic papers and all the rest of it. And they came here because I have some of the 18th century family portraits of the Stokers upstairs. And one of them is a genealogist, not professional, amateur, but very, very good. And he unrolled the thing the length of the dining room table with all these kind of family history and stuff on it. And we're descended from the Earls of Luttrell's Town, but also from Peter the Pawnbroker. And another one who was dismissed from the army in 1700 and frozen to death for public drunkenness as a private. So there you are. You have earls, pawnbrokers, and drunken soldiers.
Walks of all life, wheels of all life.
Yeah, exactly. So there's nothing to be snobbish about in the sense of thinking you're better than anybody else, because everybody has the same kind of mixture. Mm. You know, it's just a question of finding it. And in Ireland particularly, I'm descended from a whole clatter of kings of Ossory, from at least two high kings, including Mail Shocklin. But there's about 6 million other people in Ireland who claim the same. Yeah, because true. We're all tribes, we're all families.
Mm.
Like the O'Briens are all descended from Brian Boru. You know? But once you get after a couple of generations, the whole thing multiplies exponentially. So you can have a couple of million descendants inside, well, certainly inside 1,000 years.
Yeah, don't they say that about Genghis Khan as well, actually? Isn't he meant
to... Yeah, we're all probably descended from Genghis Khan. Yeah,
exactly, I was going to say, apparently, like, everybody.
Yes.
But what was Ireland like when you were growing up as a kid then? Like, you, in
well, it was Ball's very grey. It was, that's the word I would use to describe it, because it was, my conscious memories are of immediately after the end of the Second World War, when there was still rationing in this country. There were huge mounds of turf out in the Phoenix Park, McHenry Brothers, and they had lorries with slatted sides that carried this turf around all over the place. The clothes, particularly for boys, was black shoes, grey socks, grey short trousers, grey shirt, grey jumper, grey jacket. Everything was grey. There was no colour. I remember coming in about 1949 and my father parking the car just near Dominic Street and seeing all these inner city kids flying around the lamppost on a rope with violet and lavender and pink clothes. I thought, how glorious, wonderful. So much better than our awful middle-class greyness. And it was, everything was also terribly restricted. You know, nobody mentioned sex.
Mm.
I mean, if the word sex was said, the conversation in the entire room would stop dead. You know, it was unmentionable. And certainly homosexuality was completely off the register. You didn't talk about religion, but things were very narrow. By and large, Roman Catholics kept themselves, the Church of Ireland kept herself, the Presbyterians and the Methodists, they all kept to their own, and they tried to marry within their own little confines, and the social life, even like table tennis, was segregated. You know, so no Catholics need apply, Church of Ireland keep out. this sort of attitude.
This is like what, the early six, like early
60s?
50s.
Yes. Yeah. And there was a big boycott when in Feathered, there was this woman who was churchgoer and she married a farmer. And the priest tried to get her to swear to bring up the children Roman Catholic, and something happened. They didn't anyway. And there was a huge boycott. I mean, they wouldn't sell the family groceries, or people wouldn't work for them. All this terrible stuff.
That's crazy to think that, though, wasn't it? And then I know Trinity, then, which you attended, that was segregated also, wasn't it?
Yes, it was under a ban from the Roman Catholic Archbishop, you know.
It was McQuaid at the time.
Dr. McQuaid, yes. You'd lose your soul and burn in hell if you went to Trinity. Well, he was right about one thing, because he said Trinity was there to undermine Catholicism. Well, in those days, Catholicism didn't ask any questions. You know, the answers, nobody was allowed to ask questions. Any questions were, the answers were provided by the hierarchy. People didn't have to think for themselves. But Trinity's whole attitude was people should think for themselves. They should question. And that could be taken as undermining belief.
Do you think there's still an element of that within some Catholic, some Catholic for organizations, for want of a better word?
Well, I think yes, in terms of both Roman Catholic and Protestant, so-called, or extremes, yes, they're still like that. You just look at the north of Ireland.
Yeah.
You know, and you can see the extremes there. I mean, it was quite recently, there was the Democratic Unionist Party frustrated the democratic decision of the Assembly to accept same-sex marriage and so on by issuing a so-called petition of concern. And they were strongly supported by the Roman Catholic Church. I mean, it's fantastic to think of Paisley's party collaborating with the church. Yeah. But it's just because they were taking an extreme point of view.
And it's something that we'll definitely talk to you about, the same-sex marriage referendum and May 22nd and what a day that was. But just on to go back a second, what you were still talking about growing up and that kind of thing.
Yes.
At what point did you realise that you were homosexual yourself? And like how
Well, kind of gradually dawned on me, because it seemed to me it was perfectly natural.
Yeah.
You know, and I thought my friends were all going astray because they were taking an interest in looking at girls when they were changing on the beach and all this kind of thing. I thought, this is utterly wrong. You'll go blind. You'll be put in jail. And I advised them to stop it at once. It wasn't good. But then I gradually realised I was the odd one out.
Mm.
And that came as a bit of a nasty surprise. And then I realised it was criminal, it was against the law.
What do you mean nasty surprise?
Well, it was a nasty surprise to realise that I was the odd one out.
Okay.
Okay.
You know, that it was I who was odd and out of tune with things.
Is that just in terms of the sort of cultural acceptance thing?
Yes. But I also felt a freak.
Okay.
You know, I didn't, you see, because there was such a silence, I didn't know if there would be any other ones, you know.
Yeah.
Thought there might be in England, which is a sink of iniquity, to which people were regularly sentenced in the Dublin District Courts. I don't know if you know that.
Huh?
They'd be given a sentence of 6 months imprisonment or go to England.
Really?
Yes. So England was a kind of a cesspit for Irish miscreants.
Almost like being sent to Siberia.
Absolutely.
It's mad. I never knew that myself. Like,
if you didn't show the court either a ticket on the mailboat, you won't go to jail.
So, how old were you when you kind of were going through all of this?
Well, I started realizing it about sort of 8 or 9, I suppose.
8 or 9.
Yeah.
And then
as you become a teenager, it becomes more urgent because the hormones are whizzing around and all the rest of it. And all my friends were going off to cricket club dances and rugby club dances and all this sort of stuff, and I was sort of left out. I could hear the music in the distance, but I knew it wasn't for me.
Yeah. You just weren't interested, like it wasn't your scene.
Well, I wasn't interested in dancing with a girl.
Yeah.
No, certainly not. What a revolting idea. No, I say that lightheartedly.
Yeah. So obviously
I didn't see the point in dancing with a girl. I didn't want to do anything with her.
Yeah.
I wasn't physically interested. So what was the point in clutching her to my sweaty bosom?
So did your friends know then, if you weren't going to these social gatherings, your friends might have...
They did, yes.
Yeah. And how did they accept it?
Well, they accepted it perfectly, because I was the alpha male of the group. I was the one who constructed all the mischief, made all the plans, organized the kind of evil doing.
The reason I'm asking is just because it was such a different era, like.
It was completely different. And I mean, the word homosexual wasn't mentioned in the newspapers.
Yeah.
At all. It wasn't mentioned anywhere. There was just a total, complete, absolute and utter silence about it. Which is why when I took the legal action, I insisted on witnesses from all over the world. Because I knew that that would get on the front pages of the newspapers and blow the veil of silence away.
And you mentioned a legal action. So you brought it as far as the European Court.
Yes.
Regarding Ireland's stance on being illegal for homosexuals.
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about that. Like how did that happen?
When we started the gay organisations, I was involved in starting all of the early gay organisations. We had a legal section in which I was involved, and people used to be regularly arrested because it was dangerous to have a visible relationship. So people engaged just in furtive and hurried sexual activity, and they would meet people down on the quays or in public lavatories and all this kind of stuff. Now, it didn't create a public nuisance as such, but it was an easy source of convictions for a young guard on the way up. He wanted X number of convictions, so he would go to the places where gay people congregated and he'd arrest them. Very often they were respectable, married, professional people and so on. But we would represent them in court, and we had the services of a very good solicitor, Gareth Sheehan, who's now a judge. And we represented them so effectively that nobody was ever convicted, so they stopped doing it. But I had wanted one of these people to stand up and take a constitutional defence. But, of course, they wouldn't, because the last thing they wanted was any publicity. They wanted the whole thing to fizzle out and die off, and their family and friends not to know about it. So we eventually built a case around myself.
Okay, and obviously it failed in Ireland at the first attempt.
Yes, the first case was heard in the High Court in front of Justice Herbie MacWilliams, who was the only Protestant on the bench, so they put it in front of him so they couldn't be accused of religious bias. And we had evidence from all kinds of international witnesses, and at the end of it, he read a judgment where he said that there were a much higher number of gay people, he didn't say gay people, he said homosexuals, in Ireland than had been imagined. They weren't mentally deficient, they weren't child molesters, they weren't sexually bizarre and all this kind of stuff. And they weren't less educated, and all of it was like a charter of gay rights. And then at the end he took a swerve and he said, nevertheless, despite all this, because of the Christian and democratic nature of the Irish Constitution, I have to find against the plaintiff. So that went then to the Supreme Court. We appealed to the Supreme Court, and the Chief Justice made an ass of himself and completely misdirected himself in law, because in the Supreme Court, all you can discuss are technical points arising from the evidence of the first case. I was the only person who had introduced any evidence.
Yeah.
The government completely failed to introduce anything. So I should have won. But the Chief Justice went off on a kind of a mayor's chase about all kinds of obsessions and ideas that he had of his own, and found against me. And two other judges just signed his decision without giving any argument. But there were two very good dissenting judgments, Henshey and McCarthy. But it was a 3-2 decision against me. We then went to the European Court, where we won by one vote out of about 23 judges. The Irish judge voting against us.
Really?
Mr. Justice Brian, something or other, Brian Walsh.
Was this a tough time for you and your supporters? And the gay community in Ireland, I suppose. Like what was the mood? Or?
Well, the gay community were kind of pretty...
You're fighting against the state, like.
Oh, yes. Mm. Yeah. But, a large part of it was quite fun. And there were one or two sort of nervous moments, like the in the High Court, after they'd won, the government looked for fees against me. And they were awarded costs of 75,000. And I had paid 25,000 for this house, so it was three houses. But I didn't have it. So I said, well, what the hell, double or quits. But there was one nervous night. And then I thought, oh, fuck it, what about it? Don't have the money anyway, so you might as well appeal all over the place, go everywhere. And the rest of the gay community, I think, they were more into the discos than anything else.
So it was quite underground, though, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. For the majority of people, it was. Their families didn't know.
Yeah.
And their colleagues at work didn't know. And that there was a constant fear of discovery. That was the principal feeling.
And this is during all the court cases, this is the early 80s.
Yes.
And would this have been the same time as when poor Declan Flynn lost his life?
That was afterwards, yes.
That was afterwards,
yeah.
So...
Yeah, Declan Flynn actually used to come regularly to the discos. I knew him quite well.
Yeah. There must have been...
And you see, the problem with Declan was that he was very shy. He was a nice, shy sort of man. And he worked in Aer Lingus. And some Aer Lingus employees came into the gay bar where he was, and they saw him, and they made a joke out of it. And they didn't mean any harm, but it meant he felt he couldn't go to the pubs, he couldn't go anywhere where he might be seen anymore, so he took to hanging around Fairview Park and this sort of business, and they just killed him, they just battered him to death. Yeah. So, and the judge let them off.
I was going to say, you had the court case, you had the jubilation of finally winning your court case,
yeah.
And then you had the court case, Declan Flynn's yes. court case, and then the judge just let them go.
That's right. Yes.
What, like, such a...
Oh, it was appalling. It was absolutely appalling. It was kind of a green light for murder.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was terrible. I can't actually remember the sequence, whether Declan was murdered after or before or during the court case. I can't remember. I think it was fairly late in the 80s. I think it was about 88 that he was killed, I think.
It's.
I thought it was 83.
Or
well,
maybe it
though.
Was. I just can't remember. And I was actually out of the country when that happened. Yeah.
It's.
But that was a pivotal event. That was a turning point, because your average person who hadn't been that much bothered by the subject was horrible. They were horrified. And there was a protest march where there were mothers and grandmothers and husbands and children and families and all this kind of stuff. They all came out to protest at the manifest injustice of what had happened.
And do you think there was something similar then when it came to the campaign for a yes vote in the marriage equality referendum? Do you think there was something similar there when you had things, like some of the things, say, like the Mothers and Fathers Alliance or the Iona Institute or these guys, some of the things they were saying were disgusting.
They were all awful.
Like, so do you think there was kind of people who were maybe just toddling along and weren't really paying too much attention when they
you mean
this
the no kind of side drove them into the yes camp?
Almost,
I think, yes,
yeah.
There's a certain element of truth in that. You know, when they put up the photograph of the perfect family, the mother, father and child, and saying every child needs a father and mother, and then the family that were in the
That's
photograph
right,
came
yeah.
out and objected to the use of their image because they said they were voting yes.
Yeah, absolutely brilliant.
It was wonderful. And they were dreadful. I mean, things were said like that gay people wanted children as a fashion accessory and all this kind of stuff. And everybody afterwards said, oh, the no side were very polite and all this. They were fannies. They were disgusting. They were absolutely revolting.
Yeah.
They treated the Independent Referendum Commission with complete contempt. They challenged the findings of this man who's a High Court judge. Come on.
Yeah.
And they lied in their teeth about things. They were a disgrace. That doesn't mean that there weren't people who in all good conscience voted no.
Yeah.
Because I can understand there would be people who say marriage is between a man and a woman and that's that full stop. And so on. I can understand these concerns. And people, there were many conscientious people who voted no. But the organisers of the campaign, the no campaign, they were despicable.
Yeah.
Absolutely despicable.
No, absolutely. And I think, obviously, you know, yes won and brilliant, so I'll say all of
yes,
us. But,
yes, but that was a wonderful thing because yeah. the gay community, such as they are, couldn't have done it on their own. It relied entirely on the decency of the majority population. And that was wonderful, absolutely yeah. wonderful. And I think one of the things that made the difference was gay people telling their stories. And gay people, I heard them on the radio just quite recently, there was a programme about it, ringing up their grannies.
That's right, yeah. a friend of ours, James Mitchell, had his one. You remember, John, when you used to, myself and Graham used to work together.
Yes.
And a guy we work with, James Mitchell, recorded it. He put it on YouTube.
Oh, very
and
good.
It received thousands and thousands of views. Like, but like, it was one of them that, much like the home to vote
yes.
Things.
They were
seen,
wonderful. The people who came
fantastic.
From England, but also from New York and even from Australia
yeah, yeah.
to vote. It was wonderful.
Yeah. When you see that kind of thing of people pulling together, does that in any way make you kind of think, it was a very long road, but ultimately, that's it.
It was absolutely worth it, 100%. I was involved in it for 46 years, which is a lifetime, really.
You played a pivotal role in all of it.
As I said to somebody, I spent so much time pushing the boat out that I forgot to hop on myself. Now it's gone out beyond the harbour, it's on the high seas, and I'm left stranded on the shore, waiting for some nice farmer with a big herd of cows.
A bit of road frontage as well.
Maybe. A bit of road frontage, exactly. And a milk quota.
But the whole Yes campaign, everything about that, even the photos from Dublin Castle, yourself and Senator Zappone.
Yes.
Like, it's hard for anybody, I think, not to kind of even get a little bit glassy. Your eyes were sweating looking at those images.
Still listening to you talk about it, still getting a bit of goosebumps over it. Like, I thought it was fantastic. What I didn't like about the No campaign is that because they were telling kind of so much mistruths in national debates, the likes of yourself and Senator Zappone and another Yes supporter, Una Mullally, you were getting frustrated on the show, on a debate or whatever. You were getting frustrated at their mistruths that then the No were kind of saying, look, you're being very aggressive. But you were just angry at some of the mistruths.
And also this nonsense about balance.
You know,
the fact that, I mean, there was something like, some of the polls said accurately enough that there were about 70% people in favour of it. And why do they have this? And they dug up people like the Iona Institute. I mean, who the hell are they? They're not elected. They're not representative. They're financed from abroad, as far as I can make out. You know, it's ridiculous. They're a tiny, unrepresentative minority. And then they even managed to dig out two gay men who were against gay marriage. And I mean, one of them, he wasn't going to be in the country to vote because he was going to the Eurovision Song Contest. I mean, that shows a degree of commitment. I mean, so what? He doesn't want to get married. Nobody's forcing him to get married.
Yeah, exactly.
And he was asked, was he in a relationship? Oh, yes. He met this fellow at the last year's Eurovision Song Contest and he was going to meet him again. Hello. Once a year ain't very regular.
Did you know the two gay guys that were voting for, that were publicly and in the media and stuff like that?
I come across one of them who's a noted controversialist. I mean, he just he's opposed to everything. You know, he takes a contrarian view. I mean, for example, he supported the state of Israel in all its doings. Whereas I supported the state of Israel for many years and facilitated the development of an embassy here and so on and so forth. But you cannot shut your eyes to the catastrophic abuse of human rights that has become a more and more obvious feature of the Israelis' dealings with their Palestinian neighbours.
What's the answer to that? Jumping to Israel-Palestine, what is the answer to that?
Don't ask me.
It's
a very intractable problem. But as in so many of these areas, it is the intervention of the Europeans that has caused all the trouble. I mean, after the Ottoman Empire collapsed, the British and the French went in, and immediately after the First World War, they just drew lines, created new countries. And I mean, Saddam Hussein was 100% right. Kuwait is part of Iraq. There's no question or doubt about it. Always was. Until in 1919, the British went in, they drew a line up from the coast, turned at a right angle, turned at another right angle, went back down to the coast, neatly enclosing all the then known oil reserves. Well, that's not a natural country. Saddam was a shit, but he was right about that. And then they solved, or attempted to solve, the outcome of a horrendous European crime against the Jewish people, the Holocaust, at the expense of the Palestinians, who had nothing to do with it. They just decided to stuff the Jewish people in there. Terrible stuff. And it's the same in Africa. I mean, all these countries that are developed that had no recognizable geographical, tribal, ethnic, cultural cohesion, just drawing lines on maps and forcing people in, bound to cause trouble. You know, unfortunately, as a European, I have to say it, and as a Christian, I have to say it, these forces have created chaos all over the world.
Yeah,
it's terrible, and I don't know what the... I think some kind of federal state in Israel would perhaps work. I mean, there's now such a melting pot of chaos all around it, which was created again by the West. I mean, Bush and Blair. They said they would bomb Iraq into the Stone Ages. Well, that's exactly what they've done. They've succeeded. They've done it. They did what they said. They bombed Iraq back into the Stone Age. I was there when Saddam Hussein was in charge of the country. And it was a perfectly functioning, Western-oriented, secular regime. It was a dictatorship. People disappeared. People were tortured. The 5,000 Kurds were gassed to death at Halabja. I protested about all those things. I had a standing up shouting match with Tariq Aziz, Saddam's foreign minister, to such an extent that David Andrews, foreign minister, said as we left the room, "I sincerely hope North Korea out of this fucking country alive after what you just said to him." And John Gormley said, "I suppose that means our meeting with Saddam Hussein is cancelled. You better believe it."
It was cancelled, yes.
That's fascinating as well. I mean, but even looking at that and looking at everything that's going on in that part of the world at the moment, obviously you had the Arab Spring and you have things going on in Syria and that at the moment, but there's huge unrest in the world.
West has intervened all the time.
Yeah.
Any time an Islamic regime was legitimately elected in Gaza, in Egypt, in Algeria, into all these places, the West just destroyed it, capsized the regime. I mean, these people have got, I wouldn't be that mad keen on an Islamic regime, but if they're voted in by the people, they've got to be left there to make their mistakes and to learn from them. If you keep them out by force, that sure as hell ain't democracy. And I mean, I am horrified by what I see in the West. You know, people talk about Western values. Well, what are they? I mean, the United States has justified torture. I mean, to think of it, to think of the West justifying torture, the kind of treatment that the Nazis engaged in. And then drone attacks, where wedding parties are blown up. And what happened to people who are members of Al-Qaeda or wherever it is? What about it? If they are... what has happened to their right to habeas corpus, the right to be charged, the right to a day in court, the right to cross-question their accusers, the right to know what the accusation is? No. Somebody in the basement of the White House, Obama and his colleagues, decide on who from a list is to be killed. Somebody pushes a button in Nevada and somebody in the Middle East is blown to smithereens with 20 or 30 surrounding people. That's horrendous.
Mm.
That is absolutely unforgivable, in my opinion.
And do you think it's fair that America tried to justify that through the Patriot Act? And, you know, and don't worry, I'm not saying 9/11 wasn't an horrific event and it was a terrible tragedy, but it almost seems as that's, you know, the justification of almost every action now.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And, I mean, of course it was appalling for the 3,000 people who died. It was utterly shocking. But, I mean, that's a pinprick in terms of the casualties that were inflicted on the Iraqis and so on. 100,000 at least in Fallujah, using phosphorus and all these sort of things. Terrible, terrible, terrible stuff. So, I mean, if you kick a wasp's nest, it shouldn't come as a surprise that you get a sting in the arse. And that's what happened. The amazing thing was that they were able to do it. And that was what shattered American confidence.
Yeah.
You know? It was inevitable that somebody would try something. Nobody predicted flying a commercial aircraft into a skyscraper. But, you know, if you engage in these kind of tactics, if you brutalize, mutilate, and antagonize a whole section of the population, there will be a reaction. You know, it's law of physics. Every action creates an equal and opposite counter-reaction. It's the same in politics. You walk on somebody's toes enough, they will hit you.
Absolutely.
You know, it's dreadful. I don't approve of violence at all. But I can understand what is an inevitable trail and sequence of events.
Absolutely. We're nearly out of time today, which yes. is a pity, because we could keep talking to you all day. It's fascinating. But I suppose before we head off, you've had a long and storied career in the Senate. The Senate survived, rightfully so, I think anyway, survived the vote for either to be abolished or reformed and that kind of thing. Do you see any sign of reformation coming down the line? Do you see
absolutely
any of these changes?
Absolutely none. Enda Kenny got this brainwave about abolishing the Senate and tried it. And he very nearly succeeded, because a couple of my colleagues, Catherine Zappone and Fergal Quinn, took it on as a vanity project and excluded all the rest of the Senate from this platform that they mounted. And that was all right as long as it was going to win. But I got out of hospital about 2 weeks before the vote, and I could see it was going down the drain. It was 60-40 in favour of the government. And I said to them, get off the platform. You know, let other people in. And myself, John Crown and Sean Barrett turned it around in the last 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Because Sean Barrett went on the university circuit. John Crown absolutely splattered cabinet ministers all over the national airwaves. And I went on every single local radio station I could get on. And I got thousands of emails from people saying, thank God I heard you on Waterford Radio or Limerick Radio, wherever it was, Kerry, Donegal, because I didn't understand the situation, but you explained it clearly, and I'm certainly not going to vote to have the Senate abolished and so on. But there was an understanding that there would be reform. There is no reform. We're just coming into a Shannon by-election, this thing where the Labour Party, in a complete naked stunt, has nominated Maria Cahill. Now, that is a farce. There's about, do you know how many voters there are in this?
No.
A couple of hundred, about 200 and something voters. That's the entire electoral register for this by-election. And those are all party political people, with the exception of a handful of independents like myself. And so the political parties decide in headquarters what the outcome of the election is going to be. And they just dictate down to the members who to vote for. You know, it's a complete setup. It's a utter scandal and a sham and a rotten borough. I mean, the only really democratic element in the Senate is the university seats.
Yeah.
Because those six seats are decided, in the case of Trinity, by about 65,000-70,000 voters, and in NUI by 120,000 voters. Those are real constituencies. The other 43, the panels, and Maria Cahill, for example, is nominated on the industrial commercial panel. I don't know what background she has in that, how she can represent industry and commerce. I don't know. Maybe she ran a sweet shop. I couldn't tell you. But I don't see any great track record there.
And you believe that's a stunt from Labour?
I think it's a complete and utter stunt to get at Sinn Féin.
And on the lead up to a general election?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Mm. And
I thought that she was kind of be going toward, leaning towards Fianna Fáil.
Well, I don't know. I mean, yeah. Maybe Fianna Fáil didn't ask her.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would have thought she'd be more. Anyway, yeah. A lot of questions have been raised about her Republican background and all this kind of stuff. So it's surprising that Labour would nominate her. She apparently she gave out about me all over Twitter because I nominated this fellow Jerry Beads, who got into trouble saying that the house in the FICO Road was just an ordinary everyday gaffe or something like that. I can't remember. But the reason I nominated him was he was one person who stood out against eviction. I mean, here we are celebrating the centenary of 1916, and there's the government and the banks and the establishment are evicting people wholesale out of their homes. I find that profoundly shocking.
And if you were given, I know this is a kind of stupid question in many ways, but if you were given a magic wand and told you've got three things you can put into Shannon straight away that would solve some of the issues, what do you think are the three things that should be
prioritized? Well, the first thing would be I would revise the nominating bodies, revise the nominators to the panels so that 21st century life in Ireland was adequately represented. And then I would enfranchise, I would give the vote to the ordinary members of those groups. It's what happens at the moment is there are 43 panel seats, there are antiquated nominating bodies, but the ordinary membership can't vote. It's the county councillors who vote on them. They're who decides who wins. And that's all wrong. So I would first of all revise the the nominating bodies. Then I would enfranchise the ordinary members, and that would make sure that virtually everybody in the country was covered. At the moment, you just have the university seats, which between them they've got about nearly 200,000 voters. I mean, that's very real. That's very real. But Enda Kenny's only suggestion so far is to leave less than 1,000 voters for the 43 panel seats, leave himself with 11 nominations, so he does, there's only one vote, and expand the universities to 850,000, nearly a million voters. I mean, how on earth could an independent individual like myself fight in an election like that? That'd be leaving it wide open to the political parties.
It doesn't sound like there's much going on by way of the reform that was promised anyway.
No, and certainly nothing will happen now before the election.
No, not a chance, no, absolutely.
But I'm hoping, I'm running, and I'm hoping to be re-elected, because I was the father of the house last time, and I will be father of the house again this time. That puts you in charge of the ceremonies on the first day, and you get to make the speech. And I would like, I used it the last time to make a rallying call in favour of preserving the Senate. This time I'd like to use it to make a rallying call in favour of proper reform of the Senate.
Well, we wish you the best of luck with that.
Thank you very much.
Just one last question before we let you head off. Is there anything over that long story career? Is there any, like, is there one major highlight, but also one major regret that maybe you'd have about things?
No, I don't think so. I don't think I'd have done anything different. And as far as regrets are concerned, I'm with Edith Piaf. Non, je ne regrette rien. I think regrets are a complete waste of time. You know, I'm sure there are things that I would have done slightly differently, but I don't have any regrets. And I've tried to behave honourably throughout my life.
Brilliant. Well, Senator Norris, again, thanks so much for your time.
It's been a great pleasure to have the two of you here.
Thank you.
It's been great. So, listen, we wish you, again, all the best with the election, and thanks again.
Thank you very much.
So there you have it. That was Senator David Norris talking to myself and Merrow. Look, I think he's an absolute gent. I really enjoyed his company, and I think he's an all-round decent skin, you know? I think I think when the history books are written long after his time, I think they'll be kind to him.
Yeah, I think so. I think he was a little bit ahead of his time initially as well, which is nice to see.
Definitely, yeah. I think that's a fair point. He gave a few good stories as well, like, you know, the fact he was born in the Congo and then his cousin's reaction coming home and all these kind of things. And, you know, I don't know. I warmed to him. He's the type of man I like to, you know, just give him a nice hug and just say, you know, thanks. That was nice, like. But anyway, lads, that's pretty much us for this week.
Lovely.
Yahoo.
So, look, it's been this whole Skype thing, you know, maybe we won't have to freeze our arse off in the gym after hours every week from now on. What do you reckon?
Yeah, it'll be good. Do it in my bed.
I miss your faces a little bit, though.
Hang on, at the start of this podcast,
see us when you're working up a sweat for us.
Yeah, and at the start of this, you said you were delighted you didn't have to look at our faces.
I know, but you know, I'm a woman, and it's my prerogative to be indecisive.
That's true. Yeah, you're a mad bunch of creatures altogether. So you are. But look, lads, that's all for this week. A huge thanks to Senator David Norris again.
Yeah.
And if you want to follow us, you can check us out on Twitter. We're at WTSPod. On Facebook, we're What's the Story Podcast. Lindsay, if people want to follow your action over the next couple of days and months and all that with your fights coming up, but also just, you know, to get healthier and whatnot, where can they find you?
You can find me at Lindsay Doyle PT, pretty much everywhere, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter.
Beautiful. And Merrow, if people want to see the beard that David Norris loved, where can they find that?
At Merrigan Mania. And follow the Ballyrack Bulls as well, at Ballyrack Bulls.
Fantastic.
Great match today. Well done, Bulls.
I'm on the Bulls. Yep. 1, 2, 3, Bulls. Is that what you were shouting, yeah?
Yeah.
It's very echoey sports hall. I couldn't quite make it out, to be honest.
The seats were very uncomfortable, those benches. I forgot how much they hurt your bum to sit on them for an hour.
Yeah, you're basically in a squat position for the entire hour, like. Brutal carry on. My arse is killing me. Anyway, I'm at Dan John Murray on the Twitter and on the Snapchat and all that crack. So yeah, look, that's us. That's it for this week, lads. Thanks very much. I do miss your faces. Next week we'll be back face to face, but this has been a worthwhile experiment. So
for sure.
enjoy the rest of you as our weekends, and look, come on the UFC, come on Ireland on Monday, come on everything, come on the lads.
Yeah,
come on. See you later. Bye. Love you. Bye.
Good night. God bless.
Bye.